Sorry we're a few minutes late getting started, but glad to get here. So we'll begin. We have a quorum here, so we'll begin with the chair's, is that right? Chair's report. Well, we can do a roll call, right? Thank you, Wally. We'll do the roll call, and that'll give me a moment to get focused.
Director Du Bois?
Here.
Director Katona?
Here.
Director Seembad?
Present.
And Chair O'Connor?
Here. So we have a quorum present, and I'll begin with a, I don't see it quite agendized, but I'll begin with a quick chair's report just to announce that Metro was awarded a Safe Routes to School grant, and as a result of the direction provided by the committee in the Health and in Active Transportation motion, the staff developed an application and received $500,000 federal grant to conduct a Safe Routes to School pilot program. So that's very exciting. And Tam Nugent is going to provide more information about the grant during our Active Transportation report. And just give you an agenda overview. The last several meetings, as you know, we focused on the economy, and the committee has received presentations on the benefit of transit to the regional economy as well as goods movement and how that is a catalyst for economic development. So today we're going to continue with that theme, with the economy theme. We have several presentations that are going to focus on the local or personal economy, and more specifically we're going to hear about how the regional sustainability community strategy and Metro's joint development program help reduce travel costs in the region. Also today, we're going to get a report back on the health and active transportation motion that the committee adopted in April and several other reports and ongoing projects related to that. And we're going to start off with a presentation by Barry Wallenstein. We're very pleased that he could be here with us today on the AQMD's energy policy, which is really valuable to all of us to understand as we provide the oversight to our organization, Metro, on its renewable energy policy and other initiatives that help advance zero emissions or near zero emissions technologies in the county. So just before we get to Mr. Wallenstein, just to remind you that this is the last meeting of the year. I'll be working with the staff on a work program and schedule for next year. That's how we proceeded, and I think that worked very well this year for us to have the themes, too, that we organize around. And if there are specific issues or policy areas that you want to provide input on, make sure you get those to me as we start getting in December. We'll work on that work program. So why don't we begin then with item five, which is an oral presentation on the AQMD's air quality related energy policy. So
good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Metro has recently adopted a renewable energy policy coupled with a comprehensive energy conservation and management plan. Metro's renewable energy policy provides a framework to reduce our energy dependence to power our metro infrastructure while simultaneously stimulating the economy and reducing the environmental and social impacts. The South Coast Air Quality Management District has also adopted an air quality-related energy policy to help guide a unified approach to reducing air pollution while addressing other key environmental concerns, including environmental justice, climate change, and energy independence. We invited Dr. Bang, California AQMD, to outline the specific provisions of the policy. Barry holds a very well balanced education from both universities in town, USC first, UCLA second. He wants a doctorate from UCLA. He has about 2 decades of experience in urban planning and environmental studies with an emphasis on air pollution control and public policy. He has been AQMD's executive officer in increasing responsibility since 1984. With that, Barry?
You're not conflicted, right, between USC and UCLA?
No, actually, I'm not, but I'll be at the UCLA game this weekend.
Welcome.
I'd like to thank the committee for its invitation to share some thoughts with you this morning. What I really want to do is talk about our energy policy and the broad context of what brought us to adopting an energy policy and how that links with transportation, especially goods movement here in Southern California. But before I do that, I'd like to provide just a little bit of background about the region and the region's air quality. And the first and foremost thing I want to tell you is that our plight, our battle for clean air, has been one of the major success stories in the United States. We have far cleaner air today than we did 50 years ago, in spite of a quadrupling of the population. But having said that, we still have the worst air quality problem in the nation, and the health studies that have been coming out over the last decade have clearly shown that in the past we've underestimated the health impacts of air pollution on Southern California. And in fact, the most recent estimate by the State Air Resources Board is that about 5,000 individuals die prematurely each year in Southern California. As you may be aware, our jurisdiction is all of Orange County, the non-desert portions of Los Angeles, San Bernardino County, and Riverside County to the eastern edge of the Coachella Valley. So about 42% of the state's population and nearly 5% of the national population.
Can I ask a question? You talk about 5,000 people dying every year because of air pollution. Is there an age factor in there as well? Is it seniors? Is it children? Is it
it's actually
across the board?
It's all the above, Director. And it's everything from young children who may suffer from asthma, where air pollution could trigger that, to the elderly. There are certainly more sensible or more sensitive populations, the young, the elderly, and also those that suffer from respiratory or cardiac disease are susceptible to air pollution effects.
Thank you.
This first set of charts shows for the National Ambient Air Quality Standard for summertime smog or surface level ozone, the percent of people in the United States that are exposed above the federal air quality standard. And it shows that nearly half of all the excess exposures in the United States occurs here in South Coast compared to the rest of the nation. You may be interested, as shown in the blue, that the second worst area in the nation is the San Joaquin Valley. If we turn to the other key pollutant of concern where there are national air quality standards, that being fine particulate matter, or PM2.5, we also see that we carry the lion's share, a tremendous burden in terms of particulate exposure. For you as directors at MTA, I think one of the issues that is emerging that should be of concern to your board as it is to ours is there are a number of recent health studies tying near roadway exposures to particulate to a variety of ailments, including a study that came out of UCLA just about a week ago that tied it to preterm births. So this is certainly something that we'll be doing more work on and would be working with your staff. So in terms of summertime smog, fine particulate matter, what do we need to do? If we look at the fine particles, certainly we want to move forward with additional controls for the fine particles that are directly emitted from tailpipes or industrial facilities. But in addition to that, there is a key pollutant from fuel combustion, any fuel combustion, that's oxides of nitrogen, or NOx. That is a building block in the atmosphere to the formation of both summertime smog and fine particles. So the key challenge for us is how we will be able in the future, beyond all existing rules and regulations as new technologies emerge, be able to keep reducing NOx by the amount that will be needed to achieve our federal clean air standards here in the Los Angeles County area. And if we look at this pollutant, NOx, what we see is that roughly 90% of all NOx emissions come from mobile sources, especially diesel fuel combustion. So, for example, what you have done here at the MTA in converting your fleet to natural gas buses has made a substantial difference in reducing the fleet's NOx emission profile, and is absolutely the right thing to do from an air quality perspective. But we're going to have to move beyond this current state of technology to using new technologies. And in fact, if we look at the current federal clean air standards, The current standard that is on the books is a 75 parts per billion standard that we will have to meet by 2030. Our current local clean air plan is designed to meet a 80 parts per billion standard by 2023. So the plan that's in place calls for reducing NOx emissions by about two-thirds, as shown on the chart with the first part of the arrow. In the next few years, we will revise our clean air plan to achieve this new standard, which will require 75% control. It's also important that I note for you this morning that the US EPA has been evaluating whether the current standard, the 75 ppb standard, should be lowered. The Obama administration decided a few months ago to delay revision of the standard until 2013, in spite of the fact that its medical advisory panel had recommended lowering the standard. If the medical advisory panel's recommendation is put into place, the standard will be lowered to somewhere between 60 and 70 ppb. And you might say, well, what does that really mean? It means we would have to control the NOx emissions by roughly 90%. So if we think about fuel combustion, especially in the transportation sector, we're going to need to virtually eliminate the NOx emissions from fuel combustion. Obviously, that means we're going to have to look at how we move people and how we move goods in a very different way. And the activities here at the MTA will be central to our ability to successfully achieve the standard. Lastly, I just wanted to point out on this chart, as you looked at the left side of the chart and you see the stacked up colors, that represents the portion of NOx emissions from each of those vehicle or engine types. And as you can see, trucks are the largest portion of the NOx emissions, but naturally our off-road engines, our cars, even the aircraft and locomotives are significant contributors. So there isn't an ability just to innovate in one emission source category such as trucks. We're going to have to do that across the board to the degree that technology is feasible and cost effective. So the bottom line, of course, is that we're going to need to move to the extent possible to zero and near zero emission technologies, and it will have to be done in the time frame of 2023 to 2031. And that obviously emphasizes the importance of what we do today to lay the groundwork, to begin the development and implementation and commercializations of the necessary technologies, and for the MTA and others as you're developing your various transportation systems to be planning for the infrastructure that will be needed for these new technologies to make sure that the footprints will fit in the project space that you are planning. It's interesting, I think, to note that if we look at topics like global climate change, the sorts of things that we will need for our local public health and air quality purposes exactly parallel what the state of California and what the world is doing in the world of climate change, because reducing fuel combustion emissions is critical to reducing carbon emissions. So the potential is there for us to help lead the way in these technologies and to bring green jobs to Southern California and to strengthen our economic position relative to the types of technologies that will be needed around the globe, which will increase our competitiveness. One of the things that we are clearly articulating these days is the fact that the AQMD can't do this, obviously, alone. We have to have a better linkage in terms of our planning and activities for air quality, transportation, energy, economy, and climate. The photograph there is of silos. The silos need to come down, and we need to move to better integration. So, economy and mobility. The committee has been studying the issues of the economy as related to mobility and transportation, clearly we want to maintain our logistics industry base here in Southern California, so we have to think about how we can provide the adequate mobility, get the economic benefits of that, and at the same time reach our environmental and energy needs. And it's, I think, important to note that if we look at MTA as an example and your conversion of your fleet to natural gas, you have had tremendous financial savings in fuel costs alone by making that decision and that transition. And we believe that there are opportunities as we look to the future and we look to the technologies that will be necessary for local air quality purposes to bring economic benefit to the regional economy. How do we make it happen? We have to have a more concerted dialogue at the staff level as the various plans are being prepared. I can assure you that we are working very closely not only with your staff but the SCAG staff on the regional transportation plan. But we have to also integrate into these discussions fully conversations and cohesiveness with other activities such as those by the Port of Los Angeles and the Port of Long Beach in terms of their clean port planning processes. So we actually produced a document a couple of months ago. It's called Powering the Future, and we co-authored it with the California Air Resources Board and the Southern California Association of Governments to highlight and hopefully initiate a broad regional discussion about the need to transition to these zero and near zero technologies for the purposes of local air quality, climate change, energy security, economy, and mobility. And that raises the question of those of us that are in government, what role should we play and what should we be fostering? And it is our belief that the traditional roles that we have played, you here at MTA, us at the South Coast AQMD, and other government entities, are really going to be key to our ability to meet the future needs from an air quality perspective, as well as a mobility perspective. So we've done joint work on technology development. We have to continue that. We're very excited about a number of projects that we've are initiating at this time to develop next generation truck technology that would greatly reduce emissions from goods movement, to look at advanced rail technologies such as linear synchronous motors and so on. But what will really be key is for policy boards such as the one here at MTA to set the proper goals and to be providing the proper messages to the technology developers regarding the needs for the region and the region's seriousness about meeting the federal clean air standards and other environmental objectives that we have. And naturally for you here at MTA, one of the critical things is that if we were not to achieve the federal clean air standards, then there are implications in terms of conformity and potentially sanctions such as loss of federal transportation funding. So it's not lost on me that it is really critical that we come together and be able to meet the federal requirements. In addition, we think we have significant opportunities to help on the funding side for the various solutions that will be needed in terms of helping to come up with solutions to how we finance, as you have great experience in, significant transportation system projects where we're looking at long-term benefits and there may be significant upfront costs. And, of course, we're interested, as most government entities, in the ability to develop public-private partnerships and the questions that are up there about does the federal government establish an infrastructure bank? How is that established? How might you tap into it for mobility purposes that also serve local air quality needs and so on? So the pathways to meeting our overall goals certainly are building the partnerships that I've been speaking about, but also looking at the investments as having multiple returns, the returns for air quality, mobility, energy security, climate change, and so on, so that we maximize the return on dollars invested. It is going to require innovation, as I have mentioned, and certainly as we attract technology developers and vendors, we're going to have to show them the seriousness that we have as a region and allow them to have an appropriate business case. We are actively working, as you are, to try and influence transportation funding authorization. We think that you've had a significant impact when we look at the Boxer bill. And we can actually look in there and see where we've had some impacts that may be beneficial in bringing policies and funding to this region that will help us fulfill this vision of a much less polluting, much more efficient transportation system for Southern California. Now, as was mentioned in the introduction, as part of this creating a vision, my governing board asked us to bring to the governing board an energy policy. And the board adopted the energy policy a couple of months ago. And I must say that the policy raised more community concern than I would have ever imagined possible, given the content of the policy. But when you look at the heart of the policy, the various elements are listed for you there. As I've been saying, the need for zero and near zero emission technologies. And I want to be quite clear, we are actually fuel neutral, but we're not pollution neutral. If we're going to need 75% NOx control or 90% NOx control, we say come one, come all, that can achieve the adequate level of pollution control. But that we must have that sort of level of pollution control regardless of what the prime type of fuel is. We also are supporting, as you have in your policies, demand-side management programs in terms of energy efficiency and conservation and load shifting. We think those are going to be incredibly important as the state and the region try to move from more fossil fuel-based power generation to power generation by renewable sources and even distributed renewable sources. We are very active in the area of renewable generation and energy storage. In fact, we're getting ready to bring a set of proposals to our governing board in the first quarter of next year, where we will probably fund anywhere from $15 million or more and projects that will demonstrate advanced distributed renewable technologies that can be used for commercial buildings, homes, et cetera. There is, and I'm sure you've heard this from others, in spite of everyone's strong desires to go to renewable technology, we know that we are going to need, for purposes of grid security and availability, to have some fossil fuel generation. So we need to continue to ensure that as we ask communities to accept fossil fuel generation, that those fossil fuel plants are the lowest emitting feasible with existing technologies. The policy also calls for mitigation in any community where there would be a fossil fuel plant, so that if there are mitigations fees, for example, that would be paid by the plant operator, that those fees would go back into the community where the plant is located. And last but not least, of course, is public education. We all have to work together to make sure that the public understands the effects of air pollution and the impacts of hampered mobility on the economy and so on, so that the public supports the sorts of policies that will be necessary from the agencies involved in the effort. We have a number of key actions that we have underway. We are working, as I've been mentioning, on zero and near zero emission technology. My board is funding a couple of projects related, in essence, to large trucks that would be able to operate by hybrid mode. In addition to that, just this week I visited with Siemens at their facility in Sacramento where they build the light rail cars. And we've been talking to them about a truck technology that would use an overhead catenary. And then the truck could go on and off the catenary. It could be on battery power when off the catenary. It can charge the batteries while it's on the catenary. Or if it wasn't a vehicle constructed for battery power, it could operate on a more traditional fuel like natural gas, as an example. And I can tell you that they've developed a demonstration in Germany, and I've seen video of it, and the technology looks quite remarkable. And the costs, as I understand it, would be something that would also be appealing potentially to the region. We're hoping to work with them and sometime in 2012 with other partners be able to move forward on an actual in-basin demonstration. In addition to those projects, we're going to go to our board at its December meeting and release a project for development and demonstration of linear synchronous motor technology for fixed rail application, so maglev without the lev. And that has promise not only for fixed rail, but there is also potentially some application for on-road trucks where that technology could similarly be used. So we don't think there's one silver bullet. It's going to take the complete menu, obviously, to achieve the sorts of emission reductions that are necessary in the region. And the more technologies that we can involve, the better. It will obviously also create competition and some economic advantages as we look to the future over the next 20 and 30 years. We are starting a number of working groups. My board's very interested in things such as we, over the next few years, see a plethora of plug-in electric vehicles, whether they're pure battery electrics or plug-in hybrids, for the infrastructure and also the rates that the consumers will pay to the various utilities, that things are put in proper place from a policy perspective to encourage and nurture the use of those technologies by the general public and then certainly also by the private sector for commercial delivery vehicles and so on. We've also have an interest, as indicated there, in biogas and other clean energy sources from biogas. So we're looking at that, and certainly that fits in with this committee's charter of sustainability. And we are working closely not only here locally but with our state partners, the Energy Commission, the Public Utilities Commission, and the California Air Resources Board, to work on the area of energy efficiency and demand management. That certainly fits with SB 375, sustainable community plans, and helps us reduce NOx emissions, which then obviously helps us with the air quality management plan. And we've committed to the public and to our governing board to track our progress and make periodic reports back on progress in implementing the energy policy. Certainly, this is a slide we typically end with. And, of course, the meaning here is when we pull together, we can do really big things when we set the right vision. And, of course, there's a long, proud history of doing that here at the MTA. And I thank you for inviting me this morning.
Thank you for the update. Do we have some questions here?
Yeah,
Director DuBois.
Thank you. I do. You talk about fossil fuel plants. To a layperson, that's refineries, right? What else?
For fossil fuel, when I was talking about, power plants that are fossil fueled power plants. All of our power plants, unlike many other areas of the nation, are all natural gas fired power plants. We don't have any coal fired power plants here.
So
we don't burn any fuel oil here. But even a natural gas power plant with state-of-the-art technology does have naturally some NOx emissions, mm-hmm. and it also has some particulate emissions. And it's been difficult finding communities in Southern California that would accept a state-of-the-art power plant, even a very small peaker plant. But I can share with you that we have been able to move forward and site three projects in the last year. One of them is in the Coachella Valley, just past the Banning Pass, where the wind machines are. That's the Sentinel Power Plant, and that'll be a large natural gas turbine plant. There's another plant that will be going in the City of Industry. It's the Walnut Creek plant. It's a Mission Energy plant, and it'll be a fairly large natural gas-fired turbine plant. And then we have several examples where we have very old existing power plants that are inefficient, that are going to be basically torn down and rebuilt with modern state-of-the-art technology, including in Redondo Beach.
When you're talking about catenaries, and 710 is in my particular region, so I have some knowledge about that. Is there not also a thought about, instead of catenary, putting something in the road, if you will, electric for the trucks to grab hold of or be powered by? Have you seen that?
And the answer to the question is yes, and we've had discussions with your staff, and both staffs are very interested in looking again at what the menu of approaches are so that we can present to policy decision makers like yourself what various options might be and what the pluses and minuses of the options are. In terms of in roadway, the linear synchronous motor technology that I was mentioning is one possibility. There are some drawbacks to that potentially, or in terms of the readiness of that technology at this point in time compared to doing the overhead catenaries. And when you've had a chance to be fully briefed on those technologies by your staff, I'd be very interested in your reaction to the overhead catenary technology as a potential solution.
Yeah, we have looked at that in the COG, and that's we've also looked at electric-powered, if you will, trucks. And as I recall, they'd need something like a catenary to refuel, so to speak, as they're going down delivering their products.
Yeah. We will be happy to share with you, and I was talking to Hassan before the meeting, the Siemens people were kind enough to give us a video of an actual demonstration from Germany. And I must say that when you look at the video, in my view, it was quite impressive in terms of the ability for the trucks to move on and off the catenary. And the ability to have, for example, as you're describing, a battery electric truck that could go up the 710 on the catenary, and then it self-adjusts when they come off the catenary, so they can actually pull off the catenary, pass the truck in front of them, and then come back on the catenary, and it's all done automatically by a beam that is directed upwards that detects the catenary. And so they could go up the 710, take the off-ramp, have a battery electric truck that then when it's in the neighborhood is operating on battery mode, and then go back on the catenary and then recharge while they're driving back, let's say, to the port. And so it's potentially quite exciting.
In another area, we also hear some talk or see some information about expanding the rail yard down by the ports. And if they expand the rail yard, will they run into the issue of getting too close to residential areas and then causing the pollution to be greater? Because I know the difficulties they've had in the Long Beach area about the air pollution. So what I guess the easy question is, what would you think about encroaching up to 300 to 500 feet toward housing areas and expanding a yard?
And let me first say that there is one environmental impact report out for the BNS proposed yard, the Skig yard, and for the UP expansion, which is right across the street from the proposed BNF site. The EIR will probably be out in the next couple of months, and we are actively working with the ports in reviewing the documents and information so that we can advise the ports and communities. But there's several things I would note at this point in response to your question. The proposed BNSF yard, this new yard, is directly across from a elementary school, a high school, a community park, a transitional school for homeless children, and the largest homeless veteran center in the United States. The EIR indicates that the air quality estimates they have for the project for the oxides of nitrogen emission will cause a violation of the federal NO2 standard. That's obviously a real problem, because then it would require us, we currently meet the federal NO2 standard, we'd have to develop an attainment plan, and there'd be implications for the broader region, not just the local community. In addition to all that, there are certainly issues related to diesel fuel combustion, particulate, directly emitted particulate from potential equipment or the locomotives. And along with that is carcinogenic substances that adhere to the surfaces of the particulates. So our view is that these rail yards, the new one and the potential expansion, and let me just say on the UP yard, I've been down to the site, and adjacent to the site is a magnet junior high school, and then there are residents that are literally over a block wall within a short distance of the yards. So it's really important that this zero emission technology or near zero emission technology be used if those projects are approved, and that it be done as quickly as is they have an ability to acquire the technology. And so there's a lot of debate going on about these projects, and it's I think it also, from your perspective of mentioning the movement up the 710 to Hobart and other rail yards, there's also an issue about capacity, that if you look at the projected necessary capacity of the ports, if you add the new rail yard, expand the existing one, and you don't decrease in some manner BNSF's use of Hobart, then what you've done is you've just increased everywhere potentially. And so there are a lot of questions to be answered, is I guess the way I would conclude.
And there was a health risk assessment done on the Hobart yard, and I wouldn't want to live there.
There's been a health risk assessment on all of our large local yards, and unfortunately our yards had the highest risk. The very highest risk is actually out in the city of San Bernardino. There are continuing improvements as we have worked with the ports and the State Air Board to clean up the truck fleet, to make sure the trucks have particulate filters on them. There are improvements that will occur over the next decade or more with the locomotives to use particulate filters and some other pollution controls. But if you live next to one of those yards, you know, it's never fast enough that you're providing the air quality improvement as the communities are being burdened. And so I think it's incumbent on all of us to ensure that those technologies are assimilated quickly. And one last thing I would say about the two rail yards in West Long Beach. I think your organization, our organization, and virtually everyone else in government tells me that negotiations with either the Class 1 railroads is about as difficult a negotiation as you can ever get into.
You're correct.
And at this moment, I believe government has something to negotiate about. They want those rail yards. And this is an opportunity to have a discussion about advanced technologies. It's about right-of-ways and about the assimilation of those advanced technologies. If the railroads are to get the containers, the revenues from the containers, especially if there are going to be any impacts to the surrounding communities.
Thank you.
Polly?
Well, I had kind of a related question, a similar situation to what was mentioned earlier, but you know, obviously one of the strategies that we need to use is reducing VMTs. And in the in Supervisor Ridley Thomas's district, we are challenged by having the blue and green lines along the freeways. And so when we think about transit-oriented development, we're in this conflict between siting, housing close to the freeways. And I'm just curious what your guidance is on thinking about that dilemma.
This is a really it's one of the most difficult questions I think we face, actually. If you ask me, if I had a choice, would I prefer to live next to a busy thoroughfare or a freeway? The answer would be absolutely not. I can tell you that 20 years ago, my wife wanted to send one of our children to a preschool next to a freeway, and even back then I said absolutely not, and it caused quite a fight in my family. But with the studies that have come out in the last couple of years, we have to really think this through better. Our general guidance would be to put a buffer up, but we know as you and others are striving with an SB 375 sustainable community strategy where getting people out of their cars is core to that, and getting them close to transit hubs is absolutely necessary. We're going to have to do a better job of thinking about how we do that and making sure, to the degree that we can go to zero emission technology. If you're going light rail and you're getting people out of cars, that's great. If you're bringing a bus in, even if it's a natural gas bus, there are probably proximity issues, and we're going to have to rethink how we address those.
Do you have guidance on 500 feet buffer?
Yes, we actually do. And for the current guidance for small particles and large particles, the particle number drops off quickly. But the thing I want to mention, and I have good news to share in terms of the ability for us to look at it in more detail. There's an evolving concern that when we look at particle pollution, if you look at the history of particle pollution policy making and standard setting and control, we started with all particles. Then we went to particles 10 microns in diameter or smaller because those particles could evade our defense systems. Then there was the realization, well, wait a second, the PM10, that's hazardous. But the PM2.5, the part of the PM10 that are particles 2.5 microns and less, are really much more of the health problem. And now there is emerging data that says ultrafine particles are really the problem, which are a portion of the PM2.5 that are the tiniest of the particles. And there's been limited studies looking at counts near freeways. We've been involved in some work at Santa Monica Airport, looking at homes across the street from where the jets start their takeoff, and we find very high ultrafine particle counts. And so because of the emerging health data, which suggests these ultrafine particles can move around in the body and even potentially penetrate the brain-blood barrier, we are going to, next year, begin a study where we're going to take ultrafine particle measurements in a broader context throughout the region so that we can characterize better the types of ultrafine particle exposures that are occurring in Southern California. And we'll be the first region to do that.
I just wanted to briefly mention success and appreciation for the South Coast AQMD. We have been doing a demonstration project of slow speed, very short range vehicles that has been funded by the AQMD, and we got tremendous results at a preliminary report, which we're looking at 23% reduction per household from travel of both NOx and PM 2.5. So the conclusion is, boy, the electrification of the fleet really looks like it could pay off tremendous benefits if we're getting those kind of results with such a very simple technology. So first off, thank you for funding it. And also to mention that it was based on, the whole project has been based on funding that had been previously provided by SCAG and by Metro. So here we have the three large significant institutions in Southern California contributing funding to something that really has tremendous potential. So I think it's well worth recognizing the silos are at least porous. Oh, and if anybody needs there is a preliminary report available at southbaycities.org in case anybody wants to see it.
Okay, well, we want to thank you. Thank you very much for coming here. And as you noted about the interconnectedness and interconnected solutions, the whole time I'm sitting here, I'm seeing Hassan Akrata of SCAG sitting right behind you, and I'm sitting next to our second-in-command here at Metro. So I know that you all are working together,
Art and Hassan are...
Oh, is Art there? I didn't see Art. Oh, Art's in the audience. Oh, the big dude's here.
Yeah, he's right.
Oh, watch out, Barry, the SC guy's right behind you. They're out there. It's a triad right now. Although I only saw the little tip of Art's head, that's why I didn't recognize him by his hair alone. But it's great that the organizations at the upper level of management are working together, and we as a board to look forward to working together with our colleagues. So thank you very much for taking the time, and we will move forward working with you. Okay, next on the agenda, then, we will bring up Mr. Hassan Akrata. The next item is a oral report on the Southern California Draft 2012 Regional Transportation Plan and Sustainable Community Strategy. And on the great to have you here, Hassan, to present to us and provide us a little bit of a discussion on the recommended preferred alternative that is being put forward, the range of projects, the strategies, and the policies that come together to make up this new regional transportation plan. And also, Hassan's going to be able to tell us a little bit about how the sustainable community strategy supports local economy with a specific focus on household costs and of transportation, as well as the combined transportation housing costs. So, and just to get us thinking a little bit, Metro staff is preparing a board report on the draft RTP SCS that should come to the board in January. So the report could include a comment letter, and also if the committee, if we have some comments about the SCS, the staff can incorporate these into the feedback into the board report. So that's being prepared for January. So just want to keep that in your minds a bit. Welcome, Hassan.
Thank you. Thank you, Director O'Connor. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for having me. I'm going to just give you a brief overview of the Regional Transportation Plan, which is going to be released in 2 weeks by our board, and then talk about the sustainable community strategy and where we are toward meeting both the federal and the state targets. Not to go too much detail, but this plan addresses both the federal requirement as well as the California SB 375 requirements. We're clear, as we do with the six county commissions, we start the planning process by asking our county commissions, in this case Metro, to give us their long-range transportation plan. We put it together, and we look at the financials, the cost and the benefits, and the performance analysis, and we go from there. I think in this case, in this plan, great thanks from the six county region goes to MTA for having Major R and Major R projects, which are going to make us look much better, do more, achieve more, I will show you later how. No secret to anybody, we are still, even with the slow growth that people talk about, we're still going to grow by 4 million by 2035, 1.7 million jobs, and 1.3 million households. And you would wonder, can we really accommodate that growth given the challenges we have today? These growth are put on a map by county, and you see Los Angeles County is going to grow by another 1.5 million people. when we talk about a regional transportation plan and the sustainable community strategy, it is really talking about how do we accommodate growth and taking advantage of the existing transportation system and propose the kind of system that's going to work hand in hand with the urban form we have. And in this region, I believe we do have. Mentioning Measure R 3010, supporting urban form, it's an understatement. Obviously, there's a lot of projects and examples around LA County that we could point to. South Bay City Council of Government, Wally mentioned some of the work they're doing. Gateway Cities CAG prepared a sustainable community strategies for the cities in the CAG. An excellent work, as a matter of fact. Pleased with that work because the cities themselves are doing a lot of things that's going to make it easier to showcase the kind of thing that's happening in Los Angeles County. I often show our board last week, a couple of weeks ago, I showed them a map in 1990 of the rail system that we have in this region. And obviously in 1990 we had no rail of any kind. Well, we had a rail in 1920, but we got rid of it and then we had no rail. And when you put the rail system that's developing now, it's going to develop in the next few years when Measure R is implemented, it is really an amazing transformation. In a planning world, 1990 is not far, far away back. And so we are, as a region, moving toward a more sustainable future, I believe, more sustainable urban form. And your executive director, Mr. Leahy, who's still here, I think, somewhere, often reminds me that I think we need to accept that the future is different and we need to prepare for it. And I believe this agency, with the leadership of the staff and the board, is doing what's needed to make sure the urban form that we have matches the need of the people we have. Many examples of how things are developing in terms of urban form around metro station, light rail, etc. This is, if you took an aerial map of Los Angeles County today, and I'll tell you, if I go to the next map, So you see that we're accommodating the 1.5 million people without going out the fringe. We really are densifying to the point where we should be proud of the fact that you're going to accommodate 4 million people in the region without sprawling some more, which is going to make it more easier, actually, to justify some of the transportation investments we're making in this region. Obviously, this plan needs to meet federal and state requirements. It needs more than what's committed. And the question becomes how you're going to pay for it, and you're not going to like the answer, but I'm going to tell you about it anyway. Let me just say that transportation demand management, Barry mentioned that in the AQMP, active transportation, which is really getting popularity in terms of people wanting option choices, transportation system management, in addition to expanding the transit system, are some of the measures that are proposed in this plan. High-speed rail, near and dear to your all of our hearts these days. You see a lot of articles. I want to thank Art for his leadership because we actually, in this region, trying to bring some sense into this to make sure that at the end of the day, we have something to point to as a success story. And our message led by Mr. Leahy, our message always clear. Let us start by improving what we have. Let us improve Los Anne and Metrolink before we start cutting ground and putting systems and tracks in the middle of nowhere that link no urban areas. That message was made clear to the High Speed Rail Authority. I believe that combined with the discussion of Los Anne and the future of Los Anne, and Director Dupois would familiar with that discussion, I think we're at least beginning to have the right discussion around the table. And again, I want to thank Art for his leadership in this, because frankly, we wasted a lot of time talking about these things without getting somewhere. And I believe right now we're getting somewhere. As recently as last week or 2 weeks ago, the High Speed Rail Authority staff did come to SCAG board. I never seen them publicly do a lot of things, but they committed to working with this region, with our partners, with MTA and OCTA, to make sure that their plan and their business plan, factor in the fact that we need to start by improving Los Angeles Metrolink before we go any further. So I'm encouraged by that discussion. I think at least our regional council is ready to say, take this out of the plan unless something happened, and we're going to see what happened. But a great leadership by Art and others to make us at least have that discussion. You know, we still think that the alignment should be improving the existing system here in the south and also in the north. And then if you have money later, you want to build the middle piece, go for it. I think the offer is very clear that, you know, even the offer was, you know, call it high-speed rail phase one, put your logo on it, but let us do something that we could show the voters that there is something being done for the money. As you know, goods movement is a big thing for our region. It's good things because a lot of economic activity are related to goods movement. Barry talked about some of the air quality challenges, and they are big, and we need to pay attention to them. But nevertheless, we as a region need to work together to make sure we provide the infrastructure needed so we keep the jobs here, and we also clean and mitigate the impacts of this. One of the things that if you put this map and you look at the truck volumes in our freeway system, it's tremendous. It's huge. In 1998, we started, actually even before that, and I do want to plug in something which people are going to blame him for. Paul, at the time, helped us do a study on the truckways. Started a while back. It's almost 15 years ago. And the idea was, how do you get the truck traffic to move with minimal impact on the local communities, with cleaning up the diesel emissions, and at the same time accessing the warehousing and others. And if you look in some of the freeways, you're talking volumes of 70 to 80,000 a day in 2035. We done study with Metro, and we looked at the East-West Corridor. We looked at the 91, we looked at the 210, we looked at the 10, we looked at all of these corridors, and we concluded, based on the study, that the best corridor to put truckways is the 60. Now, if you remember, we started with a regional system, starting from the ports on the 710, going east, and going north on the 15. The 710 now, Metro and Caltrans is doing an environmental impact report. The 60, this is the planning study that we'd hope will be picked up to do the next phase. This generated, just so you know, a lot of chatter, a lot of news articles, you know, kind of people saying, why the 60, why not the 91, why not the 210? I can tell you that the scope of this study said, based on the information we have, the 60 is the right corridor for this east-west corridor. The next phase of the study is going to have to look at the alignment and go from there. The impact is huge for not having it, given the volumes of the trucks that is there. Another issue that emerges in this plan as a major issue for us, it's always been a major issue, but we're highlighting it, is the system preservation and maintenance. And I want to let you know that right now, I'm going to focus on the state system for a while, because the state system is funded by the SHOP program. The state system right now is underfunded by $6 billion a year. And if that were to continue, some of the highways and the bridges is going to be actually not available for use because of safety reasons. And I'm not suggesting that the region takes over the state system, but I'm saying something has to happen here in terms of preservation and maintenance. The system is badly under-maintained, under-preserved. And somewhere, somehow, a discussion has to take place how we do that. And the numbers are not in dispute. Caltrans will tell you that, yes, we are underfunding our system by $5 to $6 billion. So unless you have new revenue sources, you're not going to be able to do that. And the more you defer maintenance and preservation, the more this is going to cost in the future to maintain it. The question is, and this is just the shortfall in bringing preservation and maintenance in the next 25 years, $70 billion. So where are you going to get that money? No transportation commissions or no entity in this region or the state or the federal government says, you know, here's a pot of money where you could go to maintain it. We build a huge system, an important system. We need to maintain it, and it's getting older, and we need to pay attention to that. So, which brings me to the next financial recommendation. The plan has to be financially constrained. But financial constraint is a definition that says has to be reasonable financial assumptions in the plan to pay for the system and the maintenance of the system. Now, this is not a programming document. We have another document called the TIP. This is a plan. A plan, should it be binding to our commissions or others to be creative in building projects. At the same time, the federal requirement is clear. You have to identify reasonable assumptions how you're going to pay for what. If we take our existing resources, they're not enough to pay for even maintaining the system, let alone building new things. This is a chart. You see how our future population growth go, but you look at the last line, this is our purchasing power of gasoline taxes. It's going down. It's going down because vehicles are getting more efficient, people are driving less, and that's a major source of funding. This is an amazing chart for our region. 74% of all money spent in this region is locally generated. 11% is federal, and 15% is state. If I were to put this chart for New York City, this will show 54% federal, about 23% state, and the rest local. And people ask me when I put this chart, why is that? I don't know, maybe they have a good congressional delegation that work hard on behalf of the state of New York. We need similar things here. But the point here is we are doing our part locally to fund the system. And so when somebody said, should we take over the state system? Well, if we had the money, we're pretty much got used now to doing it ourselves. Majorar is a good example. I do believe, though, this funding that you have in front of you is not going to be able to pay for the $70 billion of under-preservation or maintenance. So other sources of funding to fill the shortfall has been looked at. And funding shortfalls going to have to come from somewhere. And there were several assumptions in this regional transportation plan where they're going to come from. And one of those assumptions is a regular increase in gas tax, which has not increased since 1991, and a replacement of the national and state gas tax with vehicle mile travel tax. And as unpopular that is with some of our elected officials, that's a form that some kind of form different than gas tax has to take place for us to continue generating the revenues we need to pay for the system. Whether it's a national gas tax or VMT tax, vehicle mile travel tax, I don't know what it is, but by the time they discuss the next transportation bill, either they're going to get the trust fund go broke, which I believe neither party will, or they're going to have to look at different form of taxing to make it whole. Right now, it's almost broke. Last time, they had to borrow from general fund. So this plan is going into very significant assumptions of where this money comes from. Most of this money is not to build the project. It's really to bring the system, to preserve it and maintain it right. If you recall, last year, you took an action supporting the Air Resources Board in the targets they established for the SCAG region. Our targets were 8% per capita greenhouse gas emission reduction in 2020 and 13% in 2035. I'm happy to report to you that, and thanks to the good work that Metro is doing, that we are going to achieve both targets, and we're actually going to a little bit exceed the 2035 targets. And that's a significant thing for us because, like I mentioned earlier, I believe our urban form and our transportation system beginning to match slowly. Obviously, when you invest in transportation, you create jobs. That's no secret. In this plan, there is tremendous job creation, Measure R, the 30-10 plan, tremendous job creation as a result of that, 4.2 million over the life of the plan, 168,000 per year. reducing traffic, improving the regional competitiveness, and the economic benefits will be more finalized as we move into finalizing the plan. This plan will last. 2 weeks ago, the policy committees made a recommendation 86-1 to the RC to release the plan December 1st in a summit in downtown Los Angeles. And that plan will be released for 4 months public review, be going to the board for adoption in April. We're going to have multiple workshops. We're working very closely with your staff. I can't thank Art and Paul and their staffs enough for the kind of work the kind of coordination that's taking place to make this plan real. So with that, I'm going to stop, Director O'Connor, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
Right. Thanks, Hassan. Do we have questions here? Okay, Wally, your comments?
Hassan, thank you. I wanted to say I really acknowledge what a very difficult job this is to produce an RTP every 4 years. And I just I work with your staff all the time, and I just want to say it's always a pleasure working with them. I think your senior staff is very talented. I think your entire staff is hardworking and very talented. So it's a real pleasure, and this is a real achievement. This is
thank you.
This is not easy stuff.
Thank you, Wally.
And thank you also for mentioning neighborhood-oriented development as part of one of the emerging innovations in Los Angeles County. Two things I would just suggest is if we're right, if we're on the right track, it just seems stunning, and it might be worth contemplating for a moment, that if we can add one battery electric vehicle to to every household in Southern California, we can more than meet the 2035 goals without any changes in land use and without an additional dollar investment in infrastructure or anything. So it's just an interesting kind of observation that we could be onto something here. The second is I wanted to ask you about active transportation. And I know there's a tremendous increase in the proposal, and everybody's for active transportation. I mean, I don't want to think that no one should get the impression I'm not, or I go around kicking dogs or taking candy from little kids or anything like that. But I do wonder about the cost effectiveness of it. Do you know? Because I think it's underneath the actual screen that your models can handle. Are you expecting, in terms of metrics, there's no question putting more bike miles out will make it nicer for existing cyclists. The question I have is, do we expect to get many more cyclists? What mode share do you expect to have for cycling at the end of this?
That's a good question. Wally, we're venturing into a new area for Southern California. You know, for a long time, we knew how to deal with the freeways, and we're beginning to get into rail and bus. I will say this. You're not going to see a lot of mode split when it comes to commute trips. You're not going to see a lot of people commuting to work using bicycles. But you're definitely going to see people accessing in transit, more people accessing transit by biking or walking. You're going to see some recreational biking and walking. We are right now teaming up with Metro to do the first and last mile study because, frankly, if there is a reason why the transit ridership is not as good as we wanted it to be, is the first and last mile. How do you get to the bus station or to the rail station, and how do you go from the bus or the rail to your destination? I believe there will be an increase, but not for commute trips and not anytime soon. That's one. Number two, I think the key to making this active transportation work is safety. It's not, you know, when you put bikeways in the street, if they're not safe, you're not going to get many riders. If we want kids to drive their bikes to school, to ride their bike to school, they have to be safe, and many, many parents will not allow that. So I think we need to invest a lot of money in making the complete streets where that if you bike, you are really safe. If a kid bikes to school, it's really safe. I believe if we do that, yes. The answer is yes, there will be. Right now, even our tools are not equipped to measure how significant that's going to be in the future.
And I'll add, I'm kind of the build it and they will come. If you are making, as you noted, if there are safe routes that people can use, they use them. I've noticed in Santa Monica an increase as we've had bike lanes. It's just been incredible, the number of folks who are using it. And perhaps not, as you know, for the commute to work, but many trips, and probably more trips, are non-commute trips. And so that really does start providing more access to folks. And
Wally, Art and I talk about this. I work in downtown Los Angeles, and when I worked for MTA in 1989, and Los Angeles downtown was a ghost town after 6 o'clock. And now you can find a place in a restaurant, and you see people walking and walking their dogs, and really walking, not driving the car. So I think things are changing quite a bit, and I believe there is a future for active transportation. The issue is going to be safety more than anything else.
And is that last mile, first mile, right. And is that ongoing study is continuing with organizations. And frankly, you know, if you sit here as a decision maker, and I look out in the audience, and I do see there's constituency for it, and it's not just the folks who show up here to listen or track it, but there are, you know, it's an emerging younger generation that wants more choice.
I just to rehabilitate my position here.
Not picking on you. I've done it before. I picked on him before.
All I'm suggesting is that I think some sort of metrics so that we sort of know what we expect, and then we're kind of measuring to see if that's what we expect, so we can make some midterm corrections. Maybe even more money. Who knows if this is really working out.
And actually, I think key to the regional transportation plan that Hassan is just overall talking about SCS are performance measures, not only of this, but of many different dimensions. How are things performing? If they're not, what are the obstacles? Because sometimes it could be an obstacle that's such a safety that's in the way that could be removed and get greater success. Say one thing, too, very exciting about SCAG being able, through the RTP, to not only meet the targets but exceed the targets. And we at Metro, I'm really pleased that we, back last February, as a board, were optimistic that it took some work, but optimistic that we as a region could come up with a plan that could meet those targets. Interestingly, to the East-West Corridor goods movement, I know the goods movement is an issue that Director Du Bois knows a whole lot more about than I, but I've been learning. And part of that, too, the importance of transitioning that truck fleet to zero and near zero emissions. And again, Metro working with SCAC to expedite adoption of these zero emission technologies throughout the region, and through our leadership on a countywide zero emission truck collaborative, is also critical to the success of the plan. Do you guys have other comments? Are you looking forward to it? Pardon me?
Just thanks. Hassan? He always does a wonderful job.
Thank you.
So when will we see the draft document?
The draft document in a week.
A week. So next week, right? Right, yes. Before Thanksgiving, then,
That's
I assume?
Correct. That's
right
correct.
Before Thanksgiving, that draft will be available. And then on December 1st, the Regional Council of SCAG will be meeting in a kind of a summit.
Right.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. December 1st, we'll be gathered at the Wilshire Grant, the Regional Council, business leaders, partners. You all should gotten your invitation. We'll be discussing the plan and the economic strategy that goes with it. So we'll hope to see you there.
Hey, thank you very much,
Hassan. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
With that, we'll move on to item number 7. That's an oral report, project briefing on sustainable communities planning framework. And I think, there we are. We have Sarah Jepson. Good to see you, Sarah.
Good to see you, too. I actually wanted to see if I could yield the floor here to item number 10, the active transportation agenda, because it seems like it connects nicely with your last presentation.
Sounds good, and I don't think we have any objection here, so why don't we move on to item number 10. Hi, Robin.
Good morning. Let me pull everything up. As we're doing this, I couldn't have asked for you to have the exchange director or Hassan to give you the answers, because we just happen to have them in the next slides, so at least some of these. Per the actions of this committee and then ultimately the board, we've adopted in April 2011, the idea of health and active transportation, and that's the focus I think we want to look at. And the director stepped out, but I was going to remind her that walking has increased with the aging population, especially those with new knees, which is what she's been able to do. So it's a trend we want to go ahead and continue. She just happens to have that conversation with me about the white beard. So the issue ultimately is that we are trying to improve mobility. That's really what we're here for. But the consequence of tweaking some of the things that we have allows us to get to an idea of public health, of which, of course, the representative from AQMD and certainly the representative from SCAG has reminded us that the days of only working on a single agenda probably are not going to be very effective, since we can, with partnerships, create a synergism, which is going to get us to, I think, mutually beneficial ends. So the idea here is to improve mobility, to increase the transportation options for people, and I will deal with those numbers in, a little bit farther in the presentation, to support attainable numbers in the SB 375 and the greenhouse gas goals as well. And the consequence of much of what we're doing in our active transportation is an improvement in health as we are improving mobility. It just is a better way to work together. So this idea of the health and active transportation directs development of an active transportation agenda consisting and considering some specific objectives. And if I can define active transportation, the reason we say active transportation, and certainly overwhelmingly it's walking and biking, but there is also a large population that is dependent upon wheelchair, on walkers, even with a cane, and we even have a population we've been tracking that is using skateboards and rollerblades and the little scooters, the Razor scooters. So they are actually being used for transportation. It's actually in the several thousands that we've been able to extrapolate from some of the numbers we've been working with. Now, this is what the reason I couldn't have asked for a better lead-in is that we actually have been looking at some numbers of the changes of how we travel in L.A. Going back to 1994, walking was about 9.1% according to the National Highway Transportation Survey, about 9.1% in Los Angeles of the trips taken were walking. We are now up to 14%. Now, that's a very important number. We will compare this ultimately to national trends to see if it's unique to Los Angeles or those regions which have begun to adopt more aggressive pedestrian and bicycle programs. And we'll look at that in cities that have not made changes at all. But we think it's a very optimistic number. It's a very good number. It actually comes from some of the SCAG work. And we're still arguing over some of the conclusions because they are two different surveys. So we are following them and trying to get to an answer there. Biking has also risen to 1.8% in L.A. County. And that's from a little less than 1% in the same period. So we've almost seen a doubling in the bicycling. We've seen about a 35% increase in the walking. Kind of important. Now, the other activity we're working with SCAG on is the idea of taking a look at our transit system and the populations that it serves. And again, these are both directed towards bicycle and walking and include the broader idea of health and transportation as well, or active transportation. But about 99% of the population in this region is accessible to transit by biking within about a 2-mile radius. And we used a 15-minute headway on this, which means if there is a bus traveling within 15 minutes during peak, every 15 minutes, that the populations have access to this 2-mile loop, and you just about cover the region. In the case of walking, that's about 93%, and that's a half mile. That, again, both of these are farther than what have historically been looked at because of a change in the FTA rules. And so we're going to follow those FTA guidelines as well and see how they overlap in L.A. and what we can do with them. So for us, of course, walk and bike trips are the lowest cost travel options in the county. And again, we're going to remind you that the greenhouse gas issues and the health issues are both secondary beneficial consequences of these policies. So if I can.
Just a quick clarification on that. So the 2 miles for a bike ride doesn't necessarily mean that there's the bike infrastructure to safely transport someone. It's just that it's a 2-mile distance away.
Yes. In fact, the infrastructure is a critical thing for any of this. Even though I might be able to walk the distance, the environment may be so hostile as to be, you know, unmanageable. But a lot of it has to do with what we've adopted as policies, programs, or improvements. And I'll use an example here a little later. This is the basic active transportation agenda, the items that are listed here. The reason I'm pointing them out now is that we are working on these various topics. We're going to focus on three of them as we go forward. the ongoing activities here, everything from bike stations to funding complete streets or acting in complete streets, supporting some of the activities out in the work area, such as Ciclovia, providing the infrastructure, the basic infrastructure of bicycle lockers or bicycle stands. The new opportunities we're trying to focus on, you've heard this morning, the idea that that partnerships are critical. It absolutely is. We have a whole new group of players that are at the table now helping us with mobility while we are helping them with air quality or helping them with health. And that they are, again, very mutually beneficial agendas. They are contributing to each other. They are easily adapted amongst the various agencies. As you heard also from AQMD, some of them might be in conflict, such as the idea of building housing near transit if it's near a freeway corridor. And so the idea of this 500-foot buffer has been part of the discussions we've had, such as the Rosa Parks project, is where should housing be located to benefit from such a useful transit center, at the same time not creating a new problem, which is large populations near air quality problems. And so pushing back a little bit, we think we've come up with some pretty good compromises. The idea of funding is that there's different funding, and you'll hear about that from some of the other partners here in this presentation. There is different money for different reasons, and again, overlapping a little bit brings in a much more efficient usage of the public dollar and allows for, with slight modification, two or three objectives from two or three different agencies being achieved simultaneously. And the other is developing policies which are mutually beneficial. Sometimes we've acted in isolation, and where there's a possibility of doing some joint policies, it both is an encouragement for more funding in some of these programs, and at the same time, it directs the agencies to work a lot closer together and come up with a much better answer. I mentioned funding. There are new federal, state, and regional policies acknowledging mobility benefits of active transportation. FTA adopted a change. I'll go over that in just a second. New federal, state, and regional policies acknowledge the health benefits of active transportation. And again, you'll hear from another agency here, LA County Department of Health, and the benefits they're receiving by using transit as a base of some of their activities. The one policy I want to bring up to you is that the FTA funding policy has been changed, which they've expanded to include all pedestrian improvements within 1/2 mile and all bicycle improvements located within 3 miles, though we are using 2 for the SCAG work. Have a de facto physical and functional relationship to public transportation. This is an acknowledgement by FTA that it is essential that the transit center, the transit station, not stop at the curb, that it basically extends into the surrounding communities. We've done some really nice work in Los Angeles. We've been acknowledged by FTA as some of the best practices, and we certainly have some wonderful opportunities to continue that type of program and to think and to use, in this case, federal money, to do improvements in the areas not just immediately on the station but in the surrounding environs that will help create exactly the issue that you've raised, which is do we have the infrastructure to support these. Here's the DOT policy as well. It's to incorporate safe and convenient walking and bicycling facilities and transportation projects. Again, along the same line, the acknowledgement that these systems work better if we think of them integrating fully into the surrounding communities and provide the opportunities for the population to connect well. And you've heard again, Hassan had said it as well, the idea of safety, the idea of convenience is essential to these systems working. DOT is also, of course, the second bullet here, which is to encourage agencies to adopt similar policies and practices. Okay, we have Caltrans also taking on the complete streets policy, and you'll hear us use some terms not just complete streets, but even preferred streets. It's the idea, again, that we have worked over the many years to get just accommodation, and that accommodation is should be taken up a little farther to a preference to a bicycle or to a walking in certain environments. So we'll work with that as well. You've heard the SCAG recommendation and the long-range plan, and this is a very dramatic change. The idea of increasing funding for active transportation from $1.8 to $6 billion region-wide is a significant modification from where we were 15 years ago. I think one of the questions that was fairly asked, which is this going to be a good investment? I think from the changes we've seen over the 15 years, we've seen some very good results, which is that there is a larger and larger population walking. The other thing I want to point out here is that walking and bicycling happen to be absolutely the least expensive travel options for poor populations in the region. If I use some of the examples, such as those in Houston, where 20% of the household expenses are used for transportation, or even in parts of L.A., where people pay more for transportation than food, providing less costly options that are efficient and have other sustainability benefits is certainly a benefit to the citizens of L.A. as well. The idea of our policy here is to establish active transportation improvements as integral to our countywide transportation system, where we have put pedestrian and bicycle and TDM into our plan for some time. We are really looking at making a more pronounced understanding of their benefits, such as the question that was asked is, have we even changed the behavior or have we changed our travel modes? And so the idea of tracking and measuring them over time is critical. Where we do great counts of auto traffic, or we monitor the performance of our bus and transit service by looking at ridership, we only recently beginning a more kind of active effort to fully understand who this walking and bicycle community is, especially as we've seen more interest from the public. The idea is also to set a mode share. LA is amazingly a significantly greater walker city than it is compared to the national model. The national model is really only about 4.7 of trips. So L.A., as much as it's known as an auto city, is probably not touting the fact it's actually a very walkable city in many places and in many conditions. So the idea is to look at what is a realistic goal for the region. If I look at some place like the Netherlands that has a 30% mode split for bicycles, well, I can dream. And the idea is, where should Metro go with some of these policies as well? It's, as I highlighted before, it's only at about 1.8%. The idea also is, as I mentioned in the case of Preferred Street, it's not just a matter of accommodation, but designing for preference. And it's not just making the minimum allocation for getting people to that have no other choice to take these modes, but also considering designing a system that is the preferred system. The expansion and the improvements in our transit system over the last 15 years has clearly come from the idea of accommodation to where it is clearly a preferred mode in many cases and the absolute preferred mode by much of the population of the county. Leverage and partner to achieve a complete system, which is, we're not alone in this. We've mentioned the partnerships before. We think it's a pretty critical idea to bring others to the table as well. So some of our partners, of course, along with AQMD, is Renew, which I'll have here in just a second. SCAG is the Compass Blueprint program that they're trying to work towards as well. Safe Routes to School, you've heard about already. They're not the only partners we're looking at, and we think there's a lot more opportunity out there. So if I can, Margot, if you can come up and we'll talk about Project Renew. I think this is a pretty exciting thing that's been done to bring this active transportation into focus.
Good morning. On behalf of the county of on behalf of the county of Department of Public Health and the committee and the director for the opportunity to address you today. I am a grant manager and a policy analyst with Public Health Renew Program, and I am joined by my colleague Jean Ambruster, executive director of our PLACE program. Renew is a two-year obesity prevention grant funded by stimulus monies from the federal government. And as part of the grant strategy to adopt land use and transportation policies, Public Health is funding the City of Los Angeles to create transit-oriented development plans for 10 of the transit lines on the Blue Line in South L.A. South L.A., as you may know, has the population with the highest overall rates of disease and injury in the county from preventable conditions such as coronary heart disease, diabetes, lung cancer, and motor vehicle crashes. More than any other region in the county, South LA is disproportionately disadvantaged and harmed by the inequities in both the built and the physical resources environment. By incenting health-centric commercial and residential development, and also by increasing the physical, by increasing the pedestrian and bicycle access to transit, these TOD plans hold a great promise for increasing the physical activity and access to physical activity for the residents of South LA. increasing physical activity, as Robin has called out, is both a cost-effective and truly a very effective way to reduce this chronic disease and maintain a healthy body weight. But more importantly, as Robin again has called out, the Renew grant stipulates a collaborative relationship between the Department of City Planning, Community Health Councils, which is a community-based health advocacy organization, as well as the Department of Public Health. These funds are being used in three important ways. We are funding the embedding of a city planner and staff into the planning department to create these designs. We are fabricating and installing wayfinding signage, and we are conducting community engagement, both design and plan review workshops. Next slide, please. Specifically, these TOD plans are taking the shape of what is called a Community Plan Implementation Overlay, better known as a CPIO. This is important because a CPIO is a mechanism for both creating and legislating area-specific policies within a community plan. And in fact, the South LA community plan is scheduled for review and approval by the Planning Commission in December of next year, 2012. By funding the CPIO, what in fact Department of Public Health is doing is we're influencing that land use policies, zoning ordinances, developer incentives, restrictive use ordinances, as well as complete streets design guidelines are in fact legislated to support a healthy outcome. Specifically, land use policies can incent the type of investment, be it healthy food establishments, medical facilities, or other recreational venues. These types of land uses are critical in building a foundation to support a welcoming, safer, and more commercially vibrant transit area, and thus affecting the behavior which we've discussed earlier about transitioning commuter and non-commuter travel behavior. Secondly, through the CPIO, land use needs to be coupled with what I'll call the complete streets streetscape. So the beautification, the safety elements, et cetera, will increase bicycle and pedestrian access, as well as the ridership of both light rail and the public transit. I will note that these CPIOs are currently under consideration to be a template adopted by the Department of City Planning to affect the planning for their 72 transit stations that are set to come online in the next 10 to 20 years. So, again, this template, which really promotes both an increase in the use of the transit infrastructure with a healthy outcome, is an important model the city's looking to adopt. Next slide. So again, the correlation between what I'll call the shape of transit projects and the transit area and the shape of our health condition, increasingly it's hard to refute the data as called out above. And for this reason, I would suggest that perhaps Public Health's TOD project may offer either a means or a model for operationalizing some of the key strategies within the active transportation agenda. Specifically, improving the first and last mile to the transit facility, promoting walking and biking for short trips to reduce congestion on streets. Thirdly, partnering with public health, housing, planning, and environmental agencies on innovative programs and possible financing mechanisms. And lastly, promoting interim and or permanent use of Metro's right-of-way for active transportation. So again, I thank you for the opportunity to speak. I look forward to an opportunity to continue the relationship with public health and MTA for opportunities for more vibrant active transit amenities and communities. Thank you.
If I can continue with the same slide, which I just want to just focus on a couple of these things, which is people that use transit are more likely to walk 30 minutes a day. That contrast is huge, very significant, very valuable, very important, and for us, of course, it means more transit riders. The idea of an hour of in a car every day increases obesity by 6%. Well, for our purposes, a congestion management plan is to get people out of congestion. The other side of that is health department's issue is getting people out of cars is better for their health long term. Those that walk a kilometer a day or so is a 4%, 8% decrease in the likelihood of obesity. Big issue. The idea also for the reduction in traffic in neighborhoods, part of our plans under TDM and other things that Metro is doing, is also healthier for those that live in neighborhoods that don't have the that have congestion, but also is related to the high incidences of pedestrian fatalities in areas that have high traffic. 25% of the fatalities in LA County are pedestrian fatalities. And the idea ultimately is also a better or higher quality city, which is promoting the idea of urban greening. And that also is something that promotes or advocates people to walk farther. So, Tam, if I can come up, the other idea here is safe routes to school, which we have been funded at this time. Okay.
Good afternoon. My name is Tam Nguyen. I'm in the planning department at Metro. The health and active transportation motion that passed, as Robin mentioned, in April, staff was directed in the motion to develop and implement the Safe Routes to School program. In partnership with the LA County Department of Public Health, Metro applied for and received $500,000 in federal Safe Routes to School grant. The purpose of this grant is to educate and encourage children and the community to about the benefits of walking, bicycling, both from a transportation point of view as well as from the improving health perspective, and to increase the number of children and adolescents who walk and bicycle to school and improve the pedestrian and bicycle safety of those children. The schools that we've identified have very high pedestrian and bicycle collisions within a half mile of the schools. As I mentioned, in partnership with the LA County Department of Public Health, as we develop our Safe Routes to School pilot program, we will be working closely in partnership with public health. The 10 schools that were selected for participation in the pilot program, we selected through a number of criteria, and mainly those included health data as well as pedestrian and bicycle collision data to identify those 10 schools. One of the key components of this program is the Safe Routes to School coordinator, who will be provided to the schools for outreach and technical support. That are involved include education and encouragement components as well as an enforcement component, and at the end of the program, the evaluation to see about the monitoring and progress of the program in terms of before and after the program was implemented.
Just a clarification on that, is there an infrastructure piece of this?
No, this is all non-infrastructure. And as we develop the program further, through this non-infrastructure program, we can help the schools identify aspects of their built environment where infrastructure component might be necessary, and see how provide support and resources as they look at sources of funding, perhaps through another Safe Route to School application, to fulfill the safe routes, the infrastructure component.
So, if you don't mind, if I ask. So just, you haven't gotten far enough into this program to understand whether that lack of ability right now to look at infrastructure solutions is an impediment, or can you speak to that? I mean, it just seems that there's structural issues related to road design that might create a challenge,
absolutely
far enough along to know?
And we just started this program. This is something where we received the funding this year. We'll be developing the program over the next 3 years. Infrastructure is definitely a very important component of Safe Routes to School. However, another component that's as important is the non-infrastructure, where we're going into the school to educate both the community and the kids about how to interact in traffic, and also begin the foundation to identify through pedestrian and bicycle audits where the infrastructure deficiencies are so that they can move on to the next step in terms of infrastructure improvements.
Thanks.
Where we are now is the active transportation and mobility concept and ideas for in the development of policy. We've mentioned to you the progress that has been made, that we've increased walking, we've increased biking as well. And the idea now, working with SCAG and doing this overlay, is to look at what does it take to get reasonable or preferred connections from all of the population of LA to our transit system in a more comprehensive way. The stress again is that walking and biking trips are absolutely the lowest cost travel option. So the money that has been spent over the years has been relatively small compared to a change or a shift of almost 5% in the case of walking. That's a pretty good return for us. The secondary benefits we've mentioned before, which is the reductions in the greenhouse gases and improved public health. I do want to add one more, which is there is an aging population issue, which is the idea of the aging population looking for other mobility options, preferring walking in many cases, or even selling the big houses and moving to small, more urbanized environments in order to have more services available to them. That's a trend we're also trying to look at. Again, I'm mentioning Hassan because he has been quite a vocal advocate to say sell your big house and expect to live in a smaller one as you age because the population is shifting. But that aging population also is a mobility issue. It's a mobility question for us as well. The next step, which is continue what some of the ongoing activities, we're going to continue to explore and pursue funding opportunities through our partners and through this combination of mixing various agency objectives. The idea that we're really want to focus on is the development of an active transportation design policy over the next year or so and bring that back to the board for a formal adoption. And the other is to continue to explore and pursue new partnerships. We've brought some of the partners to the table today, but there are others that are very interested in working with Metro over time. And I hope that concludes that.
Great. Thanks, Robin. We do have one person from the public to speak, Jessica Meany. Come on down. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, committee members. My name is Jessica Meany, and I'm the California Policy Manager for the Safe Routes to School National Partnership. We're a national advocacy organization that speaks out on behalf of students and their families so they can safely walk and bike to school. Just wanted to say I really support these conversations. It's really exciting to see Metro engage in these conversations, and congratulations on the countywide Safe Routes to School program. You now join Riverside County and San Bernardino County that have countywide Safe Routes to School programs as well as the many other cities. Also, National Household Travel Survey shows us Los Angeles County, we're at actually 24% of all trips are done walking right now, 2009 data, but our transit average is at 4.5%. So this is a great opportunity to look at first mile, last mile with walking and biking. I encourage this committee to look at concepts of complete streets policies that will really help the agency prioritize projects that will maximize our bang for our buck. Safety is a huge issue. We know that 25% of all roadway fatalities here in SoCal are bike and ped, so that's an important issue, as Hassan illuminated. Just one last thing. I think it's really important for Metro to think about how kids get to school in light of what Mr. Wallerstein was presenting, because we know across California we're cutting school buses. Yeah. So thank you.
Thanks. We have
just a brief comment. I mean, I think you make a great case on the opportunity here, and clearly the policy is going to take some time to put together. But to the extent, and I'm not sure what the schedule is for the next call for projects round, but that is kind of the opportunity to create resources for local governments to actually implement these types of programs. I hope that there's a push from staff to make that argument so we can increase modes to support some of these objectives.
Right, because the line that I dashed down to was that the transit station doesn't stop at the curb. You know, it continues. And whether it's the program tied to the city of Los Angeles, or as we look at, you know, their transit stops in Santa Monica as the Gold Line is built, that collaboration with other local jurisdictions, make sure that they are part of that. And the concept of the standard of excellence for active design is really critical, because it's not just transit stations. There are going to be other nodes or destinations that folks will go to, that how can we make sure those kinds of places, whether it's a major, say, bus stop area or an institution or destination, how to make sure that the community and city that is in can make sure that they've designed their area. And it doesn't necessarily mean some huge infrastructure improvements, but just sometimes small design changes about how things connect. As you noted, Robin, if it's a really horrible, you know, three blocks you have to walk, even short distance, that can discourage folks. So how we can make those better. I think this certainly is a very exciting project. So looking forward to it.
Hi, Robin. We did, in the South Bay, a series of studies. We studied eight neighborhoods, and the South Bay is a mature, relatively dense suburban area without, we're not particularly transit rich. The rail is, as you all know, is sort of hits the edge of it. And what we found, and Marlon Burnett of UC Irvine, who did the basic travel by design, which relates urban form to transportation, was our research scientist, came to the conclusion that certainly amenities are important, but the distance to the destinations is what is really a key factor. This conclusion was the driving force behind our development of a strategy that Hassan referred to and we've written papers on, neighborhood-oriented development.
Great term.
So if you're not going to have a lot of transit, what you really need is a lot of little neighborhood centers that are within a quarter and a half mile. And so what we were finding in terms of the data that were just quoted, in our best cases, we were having 40% to 50% of all household trips were walked within a quarter of a mile of these destinations. And if the destination was particularly robust, that is to say very compact with a wide spectrum of activities in it, then the half mile, the extra half mile distance, which in places that did not have such a robust center, there was a tremendous drop off between a quarter of a mile and a half a mile in terms of the propensity to walk. So I would hope that in coming calls and in just your thinking about it, that a lot of attention is given to the development of destinations that are closer to each neighborhood and that are sort of more or less robust. So that is sort of one thought. Then in terms of the infrastructure for biking and so forth, I'm hoping that, and I haven't seen it in any of SCAG's documents or any of the documents, that we give some thought to make what are called combination lanes, because the money of going in and investing in changing a street and putting in lanes is so much more efficient if it would also accommodate slow-speed vehicles, whether they're neighborhood electrics or whether they are Segways or whatever. And our data show that the impact of this is tremendous because a lot of destinations simply aren't going to be within a quarter or a half a mile. And not everyone is a cycle candidate. So if we're going to do it, let's think about getting the most cost-effectiveness out of it. And then the third is a kind of passion of mine, and I can't resist the opportunity. In 2001, I did a study for the Mineta Institute at San Jose State, in which we tested the prospect of using fiber network assets, everything from actual bandwidth and circuits to something like the Televillage that was developed in Compton, which you know a lot about, and the response was overwhelming. So I suggest if we're really interested in transit-oriented development in those places that have transit stops and rail, that taking a look at how you can stimulate transit-oriented development through the creative use of these network assets, I think would be really worth doing. And the Mineta study, it's online as well, but it was overwhelmingly positive. If you could get me X, then I would be interested in doing it. So, oh, one last thing on a sort of comical note. I hear all the time this business about old people my age, for example, old people, are interested in downsizing and moving to urban environments. You know, we are not. The thought of moving is horrible. The thought of living in a smaller place is horrible. I mean, my wife and I, if we're both retired, I'm certain we will kill each other. If we'd be interested in a much cheaper, much bigger place, we could double our square footage. That would be really nice. So just for the record, I think it's so easy to say that this is a trend, and I don't know anybody who would trend that way.
Okay, I think you're working against trend is all. You're the exception. And I think you highlighted the critical thing. The pain of moving is probably the biggest obstruction to anybody. So.
Right. So we can talk about trends. But see, Wally and I, we're going to, you know, point, counterpoint. But as folks... As folks age and mobility decreases, and you know, with each decade, there are different kinds of changes. But there's a point where one can no longer drive, or for whatever reason, being closer to services, having a shorter distance, having access to taxi cabs or buses can make a really big difference. And if somebody is out in a more distant area, so again, not the choice for everyone, but there is going to be a bit of a tendency for some folks to choose more compact areas. Another point that you made, Wally, I thought was really good, too, as you noted, the key, you know, the distance travel, but it's about placemaking also, and that's where that ties into communities, and it's not just rail transit, but those other, how do you make great places? How can you help create those places with the kinds, whatever the kind of transit or transportation fits them, because the better we can make our places, and that's where working with the various cities becomes critically important. Having good examples to help guide cities is important too. So thank you, Robin. We look forward to your continued work on this. And now that we have Carly back, why don't we go to item 9, because that actually is an item where we need to adopt a resolution to move forward, and that's adopt a resolution authorizing the CEO to submit a grant application for the urban greening plan for park and ride lots, and we'll take the related actions. So if we could do that.
Sure. Sarah Jepson, Countywide Planning. In this action, we're asking the committee to adopt a resolution authorizing the Chief Executive Officer to submit a grant application for the Urban Greening Plan for park and ride lots. The State Strategic Growth Council is providing funding for agencies to develop urban greening plans. We thought this was a good opportunity to advance some of the agency's goals in the long-range transportation plan and some of our sustainability policies. So we've put together a proposal that we believe will ultimately increase the value of our park and ride facilities, both to the transit system and the surrounding communities, while also reducing their environmental impact. So by adopting the resolution today, you allow us to move forward with our application, and then hopefully we will hear good news from the Strategic Growth Council sometime in the spring.
I would move the item. I think it's a great opportunity to take better advantage of an asset within the system.
Second. Okay, then. Although I could second it, too, but I thought I'd let Wally do it. Then without objection, okay, that motion passes, that recommendation passes. So, okay, it's a little few minutes after 12. Do you want to maybe, Sarah, give us a really brief update on items 7 and 8, the Sustainable Communities Planning Framework, and then strategies to catalyze transit-oriented development? Who was going to do that?
Sure. Roger Molière is going to give the second presentation, but I will make mine really brief on number 7. I just wanted to keep you informed of our progress on the Sustainable Communities Planning Framework. We spent a lot of time talking about that at the last meeting and kind of the initial principles we're going forward with, which are connect people in place, create community value, and conserve by doing more with less. And I'm, you know, always reminded by Diego and my leadership here that great principles, but how do we get to implementation? And what we've been doing over the last several months is reaching out to Metro's technical advisory committees, and we hosted one workshop, which we were pleased that many of the committee members could participate in, because we think partners are going to be a really important part of implementing the framework. And so we got good feedback from those workshops, and we will return to you after the first of the year with some revisions to the principles and priorities, and then importantly moving towards some performance measures that will help us integrate those principles and performance measures into the projects we do here at Metro. So that's
great. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you very much. We're looking forward to that too. And now, last but not least, Roger Molière on item number 8, the strategies to catalyze transit-oriented development through joint development.
Thank you.
Hi, Roger.
Hi, how are you? And I will also try to be brief. There's a lot to talk about here, but I will try and concentrate really on two items. I was asked to talk about the effect on the local economy, but of course, the main reason for the program has more to do with increasing ridership and decreasing pollution and congestion than it does directly on the economy, although a big part of the program is to gather from our real estate assets, extract the value that has been created there. Lots of these were underused or unused parking lots, surface parking lots, and construction laydown areas for which we now have a program which extracts some value in addition to the other benefits that go there. So joint development is not just joint development or transit-oriented development because it's adjacent to transit, but it has to be the kind of development that promotes ridership, makes the areas around our stations more attractive so people are moved to get out of their cars and use public transportation. The benefits are many. Listed a few. Reduced travel times, I think, is a big one. Lower transportation costs is a big one. I think one of the big things, if we're talking about the economy, is that people today no longer talk about the cost of housing without talking about the cost of transportation. It's really a joint effort. The cost of one car is something like $8,000 a year on average. If you are a lower income family and can pocket that $8 million or $8,000 after tax, you're well ahead in using public transportation. In addition to the benefits of less pollution from less cars and less congestion. Reduced travel times are a number of statistics that I won't bore you with. Many of you being in this community are familiar with the kinds of things that are beneficial for less travel time and the additional quality of life that creates. What I want to talk about really is what we've done so far. We have about, in the last 5 years, created about 36 projects or so. Even with the slowdown of the last couple of years due to the economy, we've created about 1,800 residential units, of which almost 300 are affordable. In addition, 300 hotel rooms, quite a bit of retail. These are all around our projects. And in addition, now that the economy is picking up again, we have these five projects that are likely to go in the next year or so. Certainly, Westlake MacArthur Park Phase 1 is already under construction, in addition to the others listed here. And let me just, now that I'm stuck here, I'm afraid. There we go. I'll just show you a couple of the projects. This, of course, was the before picture of our most recent project that opened. It's now a W Hotel, of course, with 300 rooms. Quite a bit of affordable housing in the project, which is both a condominium and apartment development and a lot of retail as well, right above our subway station. This also has a bike facility and has a bus facility built under some of the apartments where there's bus layover. Our Wilshire, Vermont project is, again, right above a subway station. It is additionally right next to a vertical middle school, which is a unique development here in the city of L.A., quite a bit, again, of the 449 apartments right on top of transportation and right in a shopping district. One of the things that we remark on is the fact that capturing the commute is not the only thing that helps traffic. There are, in fact, the average family in L.A. takes about 8 trips a day, if you think about it, and drop the kids off at school, drop the kids off at soccer practice, go buy a hot dog. All of these, the first instinct seems to be to jump in the car, and sometimes that's necessary. To the extent we can densify around public transit, we can cut down some of those trips, and each of those trips make a significant difference, I think. All of our projects are quite different. They hopefully fit the neighborhood, fit the tenor of the community. So if you'll see the difference between a very glitzy Hollywood and Vine and a much more rural, suburban, almost, Del Mar Station in Pasadena, which has a light rail running right through it, you'll see a significant difference. Westlake MacArthur Park, which is now under construction on Phase 1 in one of the most beautiful areas of the city, illustrates, I think, one other facet of the economic impact of transit. I think that both here and in East L.A., much of this development would never happen were it not for the fact that transit is there. That brings up a whole other subject about extracting value and value capture. But even in addition to that, I want to talk about just briefly the fact that there is an enormous catalytic effect. What happens is, when some part of a fairly depressed area becomes developed, people across the street start looking at it and say, gee, maybe we can do something as well. And I think one of the things you're going to see in this coming year, and I showed you the Wilshire, Vermont project, is the fact that right across the street we have a one-acre bus layover. Next to that, a food union owns a very old office building with a big parking lot. They called us as we were going up here, and it turns out that at the end of the day, we're probably going to be issuing a joint RFP, our property and theirs, to develop again right across from Wilshire and Vermont. So this kind of spurs other development. There is certainly a catalytic effect that goes on. Taylor Yard, we'll talk about a little bit more this afternoon, of course, as it comes up. But this is another project that has some significant benefits in terms of providing affordable housing. There has been, and I will talk about it in some detail this afternoon, some environmental concerns which may or may not be I won't talk about them until we get to the general. Mariachi Plaza, a larger project in East L.A. Again, in East L.A., I think there was no investment to speak of for 40 years. And I think with the coming of the Gold Line, that shows you what happens to the value of real estate. All of a sudden, we have nine people proposing on one development, and that's fairly consistent, consistently what we see. This is a project I'm extraordinarily excited about at One Santa Fe, right downtown. It's going to be near the regional connector. This is the first project of size that HUD is financing. HUD is giving us a $90 million loan to help finance this project cooperatively with others. It's in the Arts District. Has a, quite a bit of both retail and residential, and will certainly be a benefit to this neighborhood, which is an important downtown neighborhood. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. I'll be pleased to answer any questions. I might add that all of these projects, by the way, are done without any Metro money. We do them on leases. All of these are privately financed by private parties. They actually pay us for the privilege, right? We get ground rent. So on these projects, we get the benefit of the transportation. We have very little management responsibility. We do get ground rent. We're at about $16 million a year and climbing. We think that we do retain control, and it's important to put them on leases rather than sell it for two reasons. Number one, the project is what we want it to be. There's a joint development agreement, and they build what we agree that they should build. It stays that way. They're not allowed to change it significantly because we'd rather not have a warehouse there, for example, even though that might be economically more feasible. It stays transit-oriented. And thirdly, we keep control of who owns the property above us until we get it back. These are sensitive areas in many cases, most built right above subway stations, and so you'd rather not have organizations, which I won't even have to name, owning them and fooling around with our transportation system. So that's the program. It's a large program. I've given you really a quick overview. It's growing, and we see all the developers actually back in the market now. We've had lots of interest, and so we'll be putting out a number of them this year.
Thank you, Roger. We have some questions.
Roger, thanks. I just wanted to give you a little grief that you didn't include the first transit-oriented development in unincorporated second district, which just got approved by the Board of Supervisors on aviation at the Green Line, which we're really happy about.
Yeah,
Next time we see this presentation.
we'll put it in there. It's a great project on the Green Line. We haven't been able to do that before. One of the things, I'll give you a quick aside because I know it's late, but This deserves it. It right now, actually, Mike Bulkey is here, and it started with Mike. He said, you know, there's a strip club out there, and we'd rather not have that. Can you go talk to the guy? And I went out and talked to him. And it's called the Wild Goose. But his father had bought up the entire block. And we talked to him for years, and we ended up putting him together with developers. Mike was a big part of that, getting the thing developed. My part of the story that was interesting is I immediately came back here and said, now, folks, if you ever see my car parked in front of a strip club late at night, business, business, business. Okay.
Wally.
Roger, this is a really impressive record. I read a bit about transit development throughout the country, and it's easy to say and really hard to do. So this is a really impressive record. I am personally, however, in love with outcomes, and I don't think it's a question for you so much because you're doing your job. But I am curious, whether this is a question for Robin or Paul or anybody, are we doing anything to come back and look at what actually happens in these transit-oriented developments that get built? What happens to people who move in there? Do they really use that? What are the vehicles per household? Is there a substantial improvement? I read one study in Orange County that said in fact, one of the outcomes from our work in the South Bay was that there is, in the best circumstances, there's more walking, but not less driving.
Mm-hmm. That it's very hard to track, and I think what you're going to find is there are studies that are finally trying to track the right thing. I think the initial studies were somewhat flawed because of what I mentioned a little earlier. You don't necessarily have to capture the commute, and I think many of the early ones said you need to use this to go to work. People all of a sudden start figuring it out and use it for many other purposes and many other trips, and many trips don't even happen because they walk out and they have the services right near where they live, those people. the total effect on traffic has been starting to be measured very, very closely, and there are some really interesting studies up at Berkeley that have to do with traffic around the stations and its effect on lowering the total amount of congestion, those kinds of things. I'd be happy to forward those to you. We are tracking them as best we can. One of the difficulties in tracking them is what I mentioned earlier, and that's the catalytic effect. I'm not sure that once we do something and we start, we have a new project, that when people across the street say, hey, what a good idea, let's do some more, we often have that kind of thing happen. And so what percentage of the increase is attributable to what development is a tough thing to measure, although they're starting to be able to figure that out.
Well, I suspect that some work better than others, and it would be really good to know the ones that work better so we can figure out what their characteristics are and sort of just have a gradually improving set of designs and things.
Yes, Madam Chair. While we all the time get requests from various universities, including the two that we won't name here, for research ideas for their students and grad students and researchers, and this has been one that they've been interested in, and as we do more of these, we'll be directing them more in that way and asking them to look at the questions that we have, and those are very relevant.
Thanks, Roger. Thank you very much. Okay, I think that completes our jam-packed agenda for the day and for the year. So thank you all for your participation. We'll be working on the work plan for the committee again for 2012. And if you have some input, please provide that. And look forward to seeing you all next year.
Okay,
thank you. We're adjourned.